My dad once told me that he loved this song, and he didn't make a big deal of it. It was just a passing remark. It's the kind of remark you don't notice that you're holding with you until years later. And now I can't ever hear this tune without hearing him say it. And that's the whole reason why we're here in this hour. Someone I loved this song, and I wanted you to know what he was hearing. This is The Standard Show. Every week I take one tune out of the real book and I follow it back. I trace it from where it came from, who built it, who rebuilt it, and why it survived. Today it is Stardust, written 100 years ago, 1927, by a former law student from Bloomington, Indiana, named Hoagy Carmichael. Given words 2 years later by a Lithuanian-born lyricist named Mitchell Parrish, and recorded since more than 1,500 times. It's been a hot instrumental, a ballad, a doo-wop record, a country record. The Library of Congress put the first recording of it in the National Recording Registry in 2004. Here's the thing I keep circling. There's a version of this song I love more than I can really defend, and I'm going to make you wait for it. That's Carmichael himself underneath me singing the Riverboat Shuffle. It's one of his own tunes from the same stretch and era that we have been talking about. Hoagland Howard Carmichael was born in Bloomington, Indiana in 1899 and trained as a lawyer, a law degree from Indiana University with a very brief practice in Florida. What undid it was a record. He heard Rat Nickel's version of his own tune called Washboard Blues, and that was the end of the law. He'd already been running bands around Indiana and Ohio, booking the good groups onto his college campus, including the Wolverines with Bix Beiderbecke on the cornet chair. Carmichael and Beiderbecke became very close, and that friendship is audible in the music. The fondness for those odd intervals, the line that turns when you don't expect it. Through Bix in 1922, Carmichael met Louis Armstrong, and he never stopped talking about what that meant. Hoagy Carmichael piano, Byron Smart trumpet, Oscar Rosberg trombone, Dick Kent and Gene Woods alto saxophones, Maurice Bennett on tenor, Don Kimmel guitar, Paul Brown on tuba, Cliff Williams drums. Most of them were members of the Emil Seidel Orchestra, Richmond, Indiana, Halloween night, 1927. The engineer was almost certainly Ezra Wickmeyer. Now, that band is playing about 132 beats per minute, so nobody's in love, it's just a bouncy little dance number. And that's probably why it didn't sell. It sold so poorly that when Carmichael went back the following April to cut a version with a vocal, the label didn't even bother to release it. In 1928, Mills Music hired Carmichael as a staff composer, and he left Indiana. Mills published the tune in January of 1929 as an upbeat piano solo, and somewhere in there, the two words became one, and star and dust became stardust. And that's when Irving Mills handed it to a staff lyricist. Mitchell Parrish was born Mitchell Hyman Peretz in Lithuania in 1900. His family came through Louisiana. His grandmother had relatives there, and then on to New York. And they changed the name to Parrish soon after. He studied at Columbia and NYU. He had a hit the year before with Sweet Lorraine. He would then go on to write Sophisticated Lady, Deep Purple, Stars Fell in Alabama, Moonlight Serenade, Sleigh Ride, and the English words to Volare. He also said in an interview very late in his life that he wrote the lyric to Mood Indigo and that the credit went to Irving Mills instead. He described himself as rueful about it rather than bitter. He went back to school in middle age and graduated from New York University, summa cum laude, at 50 years old. He died in Manhattan in 1993 at age 92. What Parrish did with this melody is the reason the song is a standard rather than just a passing curiosity. There's one part of it that almost nobody sings. 16 bars before the song You Know begins, and it sets the scene. Nightfall, a purple sky, a man in a garden with a wall around it, just remembering. And then the crucial move. He isn't remembering a person. He's remembering a song about a person. That sounds like a small distinction, but I don't think it is. If the lyric was simply about lost love or love in the past, it would be a sadder song than it is. What Parrish actually wrote is sweeter than that. It's about the warmth of remembering having been in love, not the loss, just the pleasure of having had it. By the time you arrive at the famous melody, you're not listening to a love song. You're listening to someone who's happy in a complicated way that love happened at all, and the song is the only place left where that love still lingers. You will hear the verse in the next recording. Listen for that garden wall. That's the trumpet of Louis Armstrong, and soon his vocals, Zilmer Randolph trumpet, Preston Jackson trombone, Lester Boone and George James alto saxophones, Albert Washington on the tenor, Charlie Alexander piano, Mike McKendrick guitar, John Lindsay on the bass, Tubby Hall on drums, and This is Chicago, November 4th, 1931. The band cut 8 sides in 4 days that week, and Lionel Hampton said they'd been playing this one on the road in California, so when they came in, they worked it out. Armstrong doesn't sing the Parrish words. He sings around them. He kind of passes them, over them. He drops the lyric where he feels like dropping it and puts in his own. And what comes out on the other side is a performance that treats the written line as just the starting point rather than the instruction. It's one of the most quoted vocal performances in the music. Carmichael, remember, had been listening to Armstrong since 1922. There's a loop that closes in this performance. Mills published the Parrish lyric in May 1929. Don Redman had already recorded the tune in 1928. By 1929, it was being played at the Cotton Club. The record that changed its life was made in May of 1930, and nobody sang a note on it. Isham Jones, Chicago bandleader, radio star, one of the biggest names of the pre-swing era, commissioned an arrangement from a violinist named Victor Young and told him to make a ballad out of what had been, until then, a little dance number. Young slowed it down and gave the melody to his own violin. Brunswick, May 14th, 1930. That is the moment that the tempo changes permanently. Everything before that is a dance record. Everything after is a ballad. Parrish said hearing Young's arrangement was like hearing the melody for the first time, and Parrish had already written the words to it. 1931 brought the first vocal hits. That's Bing Crosby in August, Armstrong in November. Crosby was the first to include both the verse and chorus. Then the swing era took over. Benny Goodman and Tommy Dorsey had versions out back to back on the same Victor single. The publishing has stayed with Mills Music and its successors since 1929. Two words on a piece of paper, Carmichael, Parrish. Everything else this hour is built on that foundation. This is the definitive recording. It's Artie Shaw from 1940 on Fixture Records. Artie Shaw clarinet directing, Billy Butterfield first trumpet, George Wendt and Jimmy Cathcart on trumpets, Jack Ginny and Vernon Brown trombone, Les Robinson, Neely Plum alto saxophones, Bus Basie and Jerry Jerome tenors, Johnny Guarnieri piano, Al Hendrickson guitar, Judd Dinant bass, Nick Fatool drums, strings, Truman Broadman, Ted Klages, Bill Brower, Bob Monroe, Alex Beller, and Eugenie Lammas on violin, Alan Hashman and Keith Collins on viola, Fred Groner on cello, arrangement by Lenny Hayton with Shaw. That's three solos, and none of them has the melody straight. Butterfield opens by paraphrasing it. He takes the tune and he bends it, and the vibrato does the emotional work. Jenny's trombone is 16 bars, and it leaps an octave into the upper register in a way trombones will still be copying decades later. Irby Green, J.J. Johnson, Bill Watrous all come down that road. Then Shaw climbing to a high A at the top of the horn. Shaw claimed that the record sold 16 million copies and carried one of the first string sections used by a jazz band. Take the 16 million with some salt. That's a band leader's number, not the auditor's number. But the record was just enormous, and it's never gone away. One detail that I like, a clarinetist named Kevin Ritter, who owns the score and both set of the parts, has confirmed that Shaw's famous solo is not written anywhere on the original score. It isn't on the 1940 score. It isn't in the 1944 parts. It's an improvisation. And then everyone else in America learned it note for note. The other thing to know is that Jack Jenny had recorded Stardust himself the year before, in 1939 with his own band, and his solo on the Shaw record is built on the one that he played in his own recording. Quick reminder that you are listening to The Standard Show on Biggie Radio from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. I'm your host, I'm Joanna Lean, and everything we're playing this hour is listed on the website, which is the-standard-show.com. From Clifford Brown's Strings, MRC MG 36005, recorded at Fine Sound Studios, New York, January 18th, 1955. Arranged and conducted by Neil Hefti, Clifford Brown on that trumpet, Richie Powell piano, George Morrow bass, and Max Roach on the drums, Barry Galbraith on guitar. There's six violins, two violas, one cello. The string players were never credited on any release of the record, and I haven't been able to find out who they are. I want to tell you something about listening to this because it's changed for me recently in doing this show, and I don't think I would have said this a year ago. When I listen to Clifford Brown consistently, he is one of the finest, both technical, musical, and emotional players that I hear play a version of the song. I would say it's Clifford Brown, Ella Fitzgerald, and Frank Sinatra. When I go through songs to play the show, and I might listen to 40 versions of a tune before I put together a show, Clifford Brown is just always outstanding. He knows what it takes to put a note exactly where you mean to put it, the exact length you mean, and exactly how much weight to put on it. And then he does it again and again, bar after bar. Brown does that for 3 minutes, 24 seconds without ever sounding like he's doing hard work. He's 24 years old here. He's got about 16 more months to live. He only records for about 4 years total. He and Richie Powell, the pianist on this date, died in the same car in June of 1956. Thank you.
high up in the sky, the little stars climb. Always reminding me that we're all part. You wander down.
That's Billy Warden, who's Donna Knows, Liberty Records, F-55071, recorded March 7th of 1957. The lead vocal is by Eugene Mumford, formerly of The Larks, Billy Ward directing. An R&B vocal group, the group that had launched Clyde McFadder and Jackie Wilson, the group that made 60 Minute Man, recording a 30-year-old Tin Pan Alley ballad. It went to number 13 on the pop charts, stayed on for 24 weeks, and sold 1 million copies. It was their only million seller and their last real hit. It's one of the earliest multi-track recordings of the rock and roll era, and it's mixed in true stereo.
When our love was new, and each kiss an inspiration. But that was long ago. Now my consolation is in the stardust of a song. Be stars were bright, you were in my arms. The nightingale tells his fairy tale of paradise where roses bloom. Though I dream in vain, in my heart it.
Thrilled to get a request today for a show in the future from our Instagram page, which is how I think most of you find us. You can find us on Instagram, on Facebook, and of course through our own website, which is the-standard-show.com. On our website, you'll find some of our merchandise, links to charts, iTunes playlists, YouTube playlists, and all of the videos and archives of all the songs that you hear on our show week by week. Thing in the hour, and it happens before either of the records we just heard. When I saw the pairing, it really gave me pause, and I had to listen to it. Can you figure out what you're listening to? Yeah, it's Coleman Hawkins on that tenor saxophone. But that guitar style behind it, it's kind of familiar, isn't it? Yeah, it's Django Reinhardt. This is recorded in Paris, March 2nd, 1935, at a session led by the violinist Michel Warlop. This side pulls in a quintet out of that orchestra. It's Coleman Hawkins tenor saxophone, Django Reinhardt on the guitar, and Stephen Grappelli on the piano, not the violin on this one. Eugene de Lm on bass, Maurice Chaillou on drum. Hawkins was the biggest tenor player alive, touring Europe as a solo attraction. Reinhardt was a Romani guitarist from a caravan camp outside of Paris who taught himself to play again after a fire nearly destroyed his left hand. Neither had any obvious business making the other sound better. Reinhardt's rhythm playing behind Hawk is relentless and so strange. It's full of harmonic turns that you don't hear in an American rhythm section. And Hawk doesn't fight it, he just goes with it. Django's biographer, Michael Dragani, calls the tone of this record world-weary. And that's right. Nobody here sounds like they're performing a big hit. They're two players from the opposite ends of the earth discovering that they agree on something. Probably my favorite discovery this week. That's Oscar Pettiford from the Oscar Pettiford Sextet, recorded March 21st, 1954, New York City, released on the French Vogue label. Oscar Pettiford, bass and cello. Al Cohn, tenor saxophone. Cal Winding, trombone. Tal Farlow on guitar. Henri Renault on piano. Max Roach on the drums. And it was produced by Leonard Feather. Pettiford took up the cello almost by accident. He broke his arm in 1949 and borrowed a French cello to keep working on his bass while he healed. He tuned it like a bass, but an octave higher, and then never put it down again. He's generally credited as the first person to make the cello a solo voice in jazz. He takes the melody in that register, a full octave above where the bass usually carries it, and because of that, the tune floats over the changes instead of anchoring them. A bass player's harmonic instinct pushed up into a range that really lets the instrument sing. And now here's a guilty pleasure of mine. This is one of my favorite versions.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely night dreaming of a song, the melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you. When our love was new, and each kiss an inspiration, but that was long ago, and now my consolation is in the stardust of a song. Beside the garden wall, when stars are bright, you are in my arms, the nightingale tells his fairy tale of paradise where roses grew. Though I dreamed in vain, in my heart there always will remain my stardust melody, the memory of love's refrain. My heart, there always will remain my stardust melody,
the memory of love's refrain. My heart, there always will remain my stardust melody, the memory of love's refrain.
Willie Nelson, Stardust on Columbia Records, December 3rd, 1977, released 1978, produced and arranged by Booker T. Jones. Willie Nelson, vocals and gut-strung guitar. Bobby Nelson on the piano, Booker T. Jones on the organ, Mikey Raphael, harmonica, Jody Payne, guitar, B. Spears and Chris Etheridge, bass, Paul English and Rex Ludwig on the drums. 10 days of recording, most of it cut in Emmylou Harris's living room. Booker T. Jones was Willie's Malibu neighbor. Willie asked him to arrange one song, liked what came back, and handed him the whole record. And Columbia just hated that idea. The biggest name in outlaw country wanting to cut a 40-year-old pop standard. And Willie and his manager had to fight to keep it and to keep Jones producing it. It became one of the best-selling records of his career and sat on the country charts for 10 years. Here's how I think about what Willie's actually doing on this record, because it's not singing in the way you've heard other versions in this hour singing. Willie is an interpreter of song, I always say, not a vocalist in the conventional sense, the same way I put Aretha Franklin in that category. He rushes ahead of the beat, then drops behind it, then rushes again the way a horn player phrases rather than the way a metronome would sing it. And then there are whole stretches where he's not really singing the melody at all. It's almost like he's talking out the emotion of it, laying the words down close to speech, letting the tune bend around what he wants to say rather than the other way around. I have to tell you where I stand on this record as a whole, which is nowhere. I love it more than I can justify, and I have never been able to answer the obvious question about it, which is this a jazz record? It's produced by the man who wrote Green Onions, and it's got Stax organs on it. Is it country? It was on the country charts for a decade, sung by an outlaw country guy, and then there's that harmonica. So does that make it pop? These are pop standards, but they're played pretty straight. Well, I'm not going to resolve that for you, but you can listen for yourself. But here's how I think that relates to the real book. Some of these tunes that I played this evening aren't really jazz records per se. The Dominoes are an R&B vocal group. Willie Nelson is known as a country singer. And Stardust was never a jazz composition to begin with. It's a Tin Pan Alley pop song, published by Mills Music in 1929, written by a man who quit the law and a man who wrote lyrics for a salary on West 28th Street. And yet, it's in the real book, the book that decides in practice what many generations think a jazz repertoire really is. That book started as a bootleg, the real book. Students around Berkeley assembled it in the 70s, and for 30 years, it's been the most influential document in jazz education. Paid no composer a single cent. Hal Leonard finally licensed it in 2004, but think about what it actually did. Somebody, and we largely don't know who, decided which songs were in this book. Those decisions are the jazz canon now. Not because a critic argued for them, but because that was what was on the stand, and the stand is what gets called. And a tune like that doesn't just stop existing. So the real book isn't a record of the jazz canon. It's the thing that built the jazz canon and then spent 50 years echoing it back until we mistook the echo for the original, which makes it bigger than just a fake book. It's a record of 20th century America, of what got absorbed and on whose terms. A pop song from Indiana sits in the same typeface as a Brazilian song from a wooden shack outside Rio, stripped of the world each came from and just turned into changes on a page. Stardust is the clearest case of it, I know. A pop song that became a jazz standard because jazz musicians don't stop playing it. Written down as a bootleg, now taught to people who've never heard the original 1927 records and have no idea it was a dance number. One note before we move on, since some of you are going to call this at a jazz session. Settled verse or no verse, and who has the melody before you count it off? Because every famous recording ornaments that line a little differently. And check the form. It's ABAC, not AABA. Players who assume AABA are going to get lost in the last eight. You were listening to Big E Radio from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. There are a few versions left this hour that I just don't have the room for. There's always extras on the website, which is the-standard-show.com. Or we put up a playlist for my Apple Music list and my YouTube list, and you can find those all on the website. They're all linked at the-standard-show.com.
And now the purple dust of twilight time steals across the meadows of my heart. High up in the sky, the little stars climb, always reminding me that we're apart. You wander down the lane and far away, leaving me a song that will not die. Love is now the stardust of yesterday, the music of the years gone by. Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely night dreaming of a song, the melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you. When our love was new and each kiss an inspiration, but that was long ago. Now my consolation is in the stardust of a song. Beside a garden wall where stars are bright, you are in my heart. The nightingale tells its fairy tale of paradise where roses bloom. Though I dream in vain, in my heart it will remain. My stardust melody and memories of love. dreaming of a song. The melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you. When our love is new, and each kiss an inspiration. But that was long ago. Now my consolation lies in a stardust of a song. Beside a garden wall, stars are bright, you are in my arms. The nightingale tells its fairy tale of paradise where roses bloom. Though I dream in my heart, it always will remain. My stardust melody, the memory of
Jimmy Scott with Tony Licato's Stardust from an album called I Get Along With You Very Well from 2003. Jimmy Scott had a rare condition called Kallmann syndrome, which meant he never went through puberty. His voice stayed as an unbroken high tenor his entire life. The natural range of a contralto, no falsetto, nothing put on. People who heard him for the first time on the radio guessed maybe Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, assumed almost every time that they were hearing a woman. And he sang further behind the beat than almost anybody in the music, deliberately, unhurriedly, stretching a line until the band underneath him seems to be waiting on him to drop the next note. This recording is with the Hungarian saxophonist Tony Licatos from an album called I Get Along With You Very Well, an entire record of Hoagy Carmichael songs recorded in New York in 2003. Licatos tenor saxophone, George Mraz bass, Adam Nussbaum on drums. Scott was 77 years old on this session, and he'd been singing this way since the 40s. It doesn't ever stop sounding strange, never stop sounding like him, and to me, it is so sweet. Here's the last one. Samara Joy was 21 years old and had just won the Sarabande International Jazz Vocal Competition when she recorded Stardust for her self-titled debut on Whirlwind Recordings. Released as a single, then on the album, July 9th of 2021, guitar is by Pascal Grasso. 2 years after this record, she had a Grammy as the Best New Artist. It's just voice and guitar. That's the whole arrangement. And a tune that once needed 16 violins to say what it meant, she does with just one guitar player. There's something about the shape of this song I haven't mentioned yet, and it belongs here more than anywhere else in the hour. It's that Stardust doesn't open on its home chord. I told you that back in Act 1. It opens on the 4, it drifts to a minor 4, and then finds its way back after that. What that means in practice is that the song spends a long time not being where it's going to end up. A slow, spacious performance can stretch that distance until it's almost unbearable. You're a long way from home, a long time before this tune resolves. That delayed arrival is a lot of why this song makes your heart ache the way it does. You just keep waiting for the tonic. You wait and then you wait and you wait some more. Thank you.
steals across the meadows of my heart. High up in the sky, those little stars climb, always reminding me that we're apart. You wander down the lane and far away, leaving me a song that will not die. Love is now the stardust of yesterday, the music of the years gone by. Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely nights dreaming of a song. Haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you. When our love was new, and each kiss an inspiration. Is in the stardust of a song beside a garden wall. When stars are bright, you were in my arms, the nightingale.
Student in Indiana whistles something walking home from a hamburger joint and just can't shake it. He cuts it in Richmond on Halloween as a dance number at 132 beats a minute, and it sells so badly that the label won't release the follow-up. A Lithuanian-born lyricist in a New York publishing house gives it words about a man in a garden remembering not the loss of love, but the sweetness of having had love. Victor Young hands the melody to his violin, and it never speeds up again. Armstrong just sings it straight past the words Parrish wrote and proves that the melody is strong enough to survive being ignored. A tenor player from New York and a guitarist from a caravan camp outside of Paris discover in one afternoon in 1935 that they agree about something neither of them could have said in words. Artie Shaw improvises a solo that isn't in the score, isn't in the parts, and it gets memorized note for note by a generation anyway. Built in part on a trombone break Jenny had worked out a year earlier on his own record. A bass player with a broken arm borrows a cello to keep working and ends up inventing an instrument's role in music entirely by accident. Clifford Brown, 24 years old and 16 months from a car accident on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, plays it almost exactly as written and makes that the most expressive choice available to him. Eugene Mumford and his rhythm and blues group had made their name on a song about a man's stamina, taken it to number 13 and a million copies. A man who never went through puberty sings it so far behind the beat that the band waits on him. Samara Joy takes almost 4 minutes to arrive at a home chord. The song just refuses to give it to you early and makes you feel every second of the wait. And a country singer in Emmylou Harris's living room with a Stax organ player producing and his sister on the piano talks his way through the tune as much as he sings it on an album his record company begged him not to make, which then outsold everything he ever did. Which is why I'm going to leave you with my dad's song, the way I love to hear it. Here's Hoagie Carmichael himself from 1956. Listening to The Standard Show on Biggie Radio from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. I've been your host, Joanna Lean, and this episode was Stardust. We'll see you next week.